It's July 26th, and it's Rabbi Manny Shira.
Okay, so good morning to everybody. Welcome. It's lovely to see everybody back again this morning. As I mentioned last week, phones off, please. Excellent. No problem, it's good to turn it off now. Maybe before I start, I'd like to dedicate the shir Le'ilu Nishmat, my grandmother, Aleha Shalom. She passed away 9 years ago today. Her name is Toiva Bat Avram. Please God, it should be Le'ilu Nishama. And we should do some good learning. And she certainly had an enormous impact positively in every way on me. I'm sure she'd love to be sitting here whether or not she enjoyed what I said. She'd say it was wonderful either way. So that I know without a shadow of a doubt. I promised you last week that we'd start a new series. I'm conscious of the fact that last week we tackled a big topic and we did it fast and we really needed more time, and please God, we'll come back. This new series that I'd like to start is very complicated. There's a lot of detail. It's not an easy issue on any level. But the good news is I'm going to take it slowly, and we're going to do it methodically so that we can understand it properly and not try to run through too much too quickly. So what I'd like to do today is set the foundations. The issue we're dealing with is the unborn child, and there are a number of fascinating modern and classic applications of the halachic and hashgafic issues here. Abortion, obviously, we'll start with today, and we'll go to part two next time. But abortion is not just a matter today of terminating a pregnancy. There are other issues in terms of modern technology, for example, genetic selection of embryos, which we now can do at a very early stage, which involves us manipulating with embryos and changing embryos. What are the implications of that? Today you can have children who have at least three parents. You can have father, you can have a mother, you can have a mitochondrial donor, you can have an egg donor and a sperm donor and a surrogate mother. You can have a whole panoply of different parents in different ways. Now, we had a shiur on surrogacy some time ago, and I'm not going to do that again, but that kind of issue. And then, of course, the disposal of embryos if they do genetic screening and they find that a number of them have abnormalities, can they just flush them down the sink? Is there anything they should do with it? Are there halachic issues? We won't deal with that explicitly today, but we will talk about that in the next few weeks. So today, I'd like to start with abortion and try and understand really what's going on here. Let's start with a little bit of philosophy, which I think would be very helpful and useful. If you look on the sheets here, look at the first point here. I've raised the question, there are a lot of ethical issues here. Do you have a sheet? Would you like one? No problem, I have a little spare, just in case.
No problem.
Let's have a look at the very beginning here. In all of these medical ethical issues, there's an initial question, which is, what is ethics? And do we have, from a Jewish perspective, a concept of ethics at all? Many, many years ago, Plato asked the famous question in a dialogue that he wrote called Euthyphro, where he sets up a conversation between Socrates and Euthyphro, where Socrates basically asked the following question. I put the wording at the bottom. He says, is the pious loved by the gods because it is pious, or is it pious because it is loved by the gods? This is a very famous philosophical question, which in our words today, in terms of halakha, means, is halakha good because God said that's what we should do, because that's the Dvar Hashem, and therefore whatever God says, that's what makes it good. God could say this, he could say the opposite. Either way, that would be the correct ethical thing to do. Or is that what Hashem told us to do because it is good? Meaning there is some background objective definition of good, of ethically proper, and since God wants us to do that which is good, so he tells us do this. But irrespective of what God says, it is intrinsically good. The upshot of this really is there a concept of ethics beyond halakha? to which halakha has in some way to conform or take into account? Does ethics exist as far as we're concerned? So the first answer, this is a whole shiur in and of itself, I just wanted to give to whet your appetites with this, but the Chazon Ish, when he talks about these issues in number one, says very clearly no. He says, chovot hamusuriyot, ethical obligations, heima lefa'amim guf echad, although he says lefa'amim, interestingly, he says they are often one body, they are one thing in piskei halacha, together with halacha. Ethics and halacha is the same thing, says the Chazon Ish. The halacha, hi hama'achrat et ha'asur v'amutar. It's halacha and only halacha which tells us what is asur, what is prohibited, and what is permitted. Shel torat ha'musar, when it comes to ethical issues. So the Chazon Ish seems very clear that in terms of the Euthyphro dilemma, is it halacha because it's good or is it good because it's halacha? The answer is, it's good because it's halakha. The halakha is the machriya. At the end of the day, we have no other system than the halakha, which of course is not so straightforward, because halakha doesn't always give us an easy answer to some of these modern day questions. Now, abortion is not a modern question. Abortion is as old as the hills. As long as people have been becoming pregnant, people have been thinking about the ethics of abortion. But now we have other questions like surrogacy, which simply didn't exist in the time of Chazal. For example, even abortion, even though abortion's always existed, the question of abortion back in the day used to be abortion to save the life of the mother. Because we didn't really know much about the unborn child. We couldn't get into the womb to look at it. We just knew that this child was endangering the life of the mother. We'll see about that next week. And therefore the question usually was, can we abort the child to save the life of the mother? That is almost never the question anymore with abortion. Almost never the question. Because Baruch Hashem, with medical advances, the mother's life is very rarely endangered. The question now usually is that we've looked at the embryo, we've looked at the fetus, and we've seen there are abnormalities, etc. There's nothing to do with the life of the mother. How do we deal with in utero abnormalities? And does the halacha talk about that? Because Chazal had no real reference point on that. They didn't have anything to say, or did they? We'll see next week about the fetus in utero. And surrogacy, this is what I said about mitochondrial donors and egg donors and sperm. Chazal are not mityachet to this. They don't deal with this. And therefore, how is halacha going to help us? We'll talk more about that as we go through. But I brought you a piece by Rabbi Sacks. I don't want to get too into this now because I want to get into the actual issue itself. But Rabbi Sacks deals with this in his book, To Heal a Fractured World. And I'd like to just maybe read what he says with you, because it'll get you thinking about it. He says, Plato's dilemma is elegant, number two, because it forces us to make a choice between two invidious possibilities. Religion is either opposed to ethics or superfluous to ethics, meaning Plato set us up. Either way, religion is not necessary, because either it goes against what's ethical or it says the same thing, in which case why do I need it? So Plato has set us up for a fall. In fact, however, Plato's dilemma belongs to a particular time and place. Athens in the 4th century BCE. The culture of Plato's day was mythic, polytheistic. The gods fought and committed appalling crimes. He says here, Greek myth is amoral or pre-moral, and what Plato represents is one of the earliest attempts to think morally by breaking free from the mythical past. This is very interesting, meaning Plato is dealing with the gods, with pagan, polytheistic gods. And Rabbi Sacks is going to explain why that gave him a moral problem. We're not dealing with the gods. We're dealing with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Looking back at the hindsight of history, we can see that for Plato, to be moral was to liberate yourself from the world of myth. Much as Abraham in Jewish tradition could only arrive at truth by breaking his father's idol, in their different ways, Abraham and Plato were both iconoclasts. This is why Rabbi Sacks is such a soothing voice to the modern troubled, perplexed mind. Just like the Rambam wrote the Guide to the Perplexed in the 12th century for people who felt this tension between, on the one hand, being philosophical, on the other hand, having the Torah. That was the perplexity he was trying to solve. So too, Rabbi Sacks speaks to a modern, rational mind and helps us understand how actually Plato and Abdul Avram Avinu were really coming for a little bit from the same place. So you can be happy reading your Plato, and you can be happy reading your Chumash, and you can move on from there. On the second paragraph, he says, in Judaism, the Euthyphro dilemma does not exist. God commands the good because it is good. So that he says, that's definitely what God says is good because existentially it's good. Without this assumption, Abram's challenge over the fate of Sodom, Hashofit kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat, would be incomprehensible. Think about what Abram says to God. How can you destroy Sodom? Aren't you the Shofet kol ha'aretz? Aren't you the judge of the world? Don't you have to be just? Which of course sounds very clearly like there is ethics beyond God's will. Because Abram is challenging God and saying to him, you can't destroy Sodom because it's not the right thing to do. Well, if God's word is the right thing to do, then what are we arguing about? So on the one hand, says Rabbi Sacks, clearly there is a good which exists in and of itself. God and humans are equally answerable to the claims of justice, which is actually, I think, a bit of a bold comment to make. But the good is what God commands because, and here he gets us out of the problem, God the lawgiver is also God the creator and redeemer. Morality mirrors the deep structure of the universe that God made and called good. Remember, God creates the universe by he tov ma'od. The creation itself is good. Plato's challenge arises because the Greek gods were not creators. Matter was eternal, that's what the Greeks felt. The gods had no special authority except for the fact that they were held to be powerful. Plato was therefore correct to challenge the popular cults of his day by in effect drawing a principal distinction between might and right. The gods may be strong, but that is no reason to invest them with moral authority. For the Bible, however, God, who teaches us how to act in the world, is also the maker of the world in which we act. This means that in monotheism, morality means going with, not against, the grain of the cosmos and history. God himself empowers his prophets to challenge kings, even himself in the name of justice or mercy. To be sure, there are occasions, and it talks about the Akedah, where in which God seems to demand pure obedience, but this itself suggests that the story may be more subtle. Taken as a whole, Judaism embodies divine faith in the moral capacity and literacy of humankind. And therefore Rabbi Sacks has on the one hand told us there is an ethics, there is an objective ethics, that's why God says to Abram says to God the you must do the right thing. On the other hand, he gets us out of Plato's problem by saying that God, the creator of the world, is the creator of the ethical system, and therefore the halakha, which also comes from God, mirrors the ethics, and therefore we get back to the Chazon Ish, which is we don't have to worry about the ethical problems because the halakha will ultimately solve them. We don't have Euthyphro's, we don't have Plato's dichotomy in the same way. I just wanted to raise that at the beginning, because when we're talking about abortion and these other medical ethical issues, we need to have an understanding a little bit about ethics and halakha, and when we're bringing all these sources from our classic halakhic works, we have to know why we're doing that, and that's why I wanted to bring that. So let's talk about abortion. Now, abortion, interestingly, of course, those of you who come from North America, especially the United States of America, will know that abortion has for decades and still remains an extremely tense issue in America. Not so in Israel in the same way. And that's an interesting question. Meaning we have our tense issues in this country, as I'm sure you're aware. But abortion, it doesn't seem to be one on the whole. And the question is why? That's a bit strange. Why isn't there a religious, secular fight about abortion in the same way as there is about filling the gaps? Okay? And I'm not saying it's a non-issue, it is an issue, but we seem to have like pushed it under the radar, and I'd like to suggest a few reasons maybe why that is as we go through. But abortion is legal in this country. Every year in Israel there are around 22,000 legal abortions. And possibly another 10,000 illegal abortions. There is no right to abortion in this country. Like after Roe versus Wade in America, there is a right to an abortion. In this country, there's no right to an abortion under Israeli law. There has to be you have to satisfy one of four criteria, which I'm not going into now. Maybe next week we'll talk more. We're talking about the different kinds of reasons for abortion. And therefore, you have to fall within certain criteria. However, in principle, even though there's no right to abortion, 97 to 98% of the people who apply for abortions get their abortions. And therefore, Lamaisa, in practice, the abortion rate here is quite liberal. So maybe that's the reason why actually nobody's fighting about it. Because the right wing and more religious community can be happy that, well, there's no right to abortion in this country. Whereas the left wing, more liberal community can say, okay, but Lamaisa, everybody gets the abortion who wants the abortion. And by the way, abortions are allowed in this country much later. than they are in many states in America, which is a point that we'll mention maybe next week as well. So somehow or other we've managed to keep everybody happy, everybody feels that they've achieved their moral or political victories, and therefore it's not necessarily a major issue. But let's get into the halakha rather than the law or the ethics. Abortion is prohibited in halakha. The only question is why. And let's go through basically three different options as to why, or four maybe different options in the Tadei Shir as to why abortion might be asur. And then we'll build on that next week and we'll look at the different types of reasons for abortion that are suggested today. The starting point on all shirim on abortion has to be source number three, which is a pasuk in Shemot. This is the only explicit source in the Torah that deals with abortion. Ki yinatsu anashim, when men are fighting, which men unfortunately sometimes do, v'nakfu isha hara, and a woman who is pregnant is injured in this fight. Somebody lashes out, throws a rock, whatever it is, and a woman who is pregnant is injured. V'yatsu yiladeha, and she loses the baby. She loses her child. Maybe even children yiladeha, but I think this means the blood inside. The loyatson, but there is no disaster. Now, the Torah doesn't define what the disaster is, more about that in a minute. Then what should happen? Anosh yanesh. There has to be a punishment to the men who are fighting, the man who hit her. Rashi explains the shalem demei vladot labal. He has to pay financial compensation for having caused the woman to lose the baby. That's the onesh. Ka'ashe yashit alav bal ha'isha. If the husband of the injured woman decides to sue, v'natan b'klilim, and go to court. It sounds like that the punishment, if you like, the penalty for causing an abortion is financial. Ve'im ason yiyeh, that if there's a disaster, v'natata nefesh kachas nefesh, then you have to take a life for a life. Now, what is the disaster that's talking about? So our tradition and Rashi etc. and all the Forshim understand that the disaster is if the woman, God forbid, dies. If the woman is injured so badly that not only does she lose the baby, but she dies as well, then that is murder. There's a capital crime involved here. Now, leaving aside the question of, is it really murder? Did he intend to hurt her? And if there's no mens rea, if there's no intention, I'm not getting into all that now because we're not doing a shir about that issue. But that's how we understand the word asan. Yes, you had a question? Yes, because it says ki yinatsu anashim. You want to say anashim means that she's fighting as well? Pregnant women don't normally get into fights, but I don't think he means that. I think he means she is an innocent bystander. Now, what's interesting, I didn't put it in your sheets, but even though the rabbis, Chazal, clearly understood that in this last part, the asan is the woman dying, the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Torah, which is a very Christological document now, meaning the Gemara talks about the rabbis translating the Septuagint, the Torah, into Greek. What we have now is the Greek translation of the Torah is not really the one that the rabbis did back in the time of the Bais Sheni. It's a much more Christological, Christian influenced document. But there, if you look in the Septuagint, it says the Asan is not that the woman dies, but it says if the baby was perfectly formed and the baby died, then that is murder. If the fetus died, then that is murder. And therefore, interestingly, that for the Christians is very much a starting point for their approach, certainly the Catholic approach, which is that abortion is definitely murder. And as we'll see next week, even when the life of the mother is endangered, the Catholic position is that you can't do anything because better two deaths than one murder. Now, we do not say that. We'll see that next week very clearly. But there's already a difference of view starting at this point in the pasuk between us. We say no. At the end of the day, the penalty for the loss of the fetus is financial. Only the loss of the mother would be a capital crime. So it seems just from this starting point that we're dealing with a financial penalty. If it's a financial penalty, then abortion doesn't sound like it's going to be murder or homicide in any way. Although we'll see this is just the beginning of the discussion. The Mechilta picks this up in number four. The Mechilta comes from Chazal, same sort of time as the Gemara. And he said, Chazal says as follows, Anoshi Anesh. What does it mean that the person has to be punished for causing the loss of the fetus? Mamon. Money, that's what he has to pay. Do you mean money or eina ela misa, or maybe you mean the death penalty? Hari atadan, he says no, because you can see nema kan anosh, the word enosh here, anosh, onesh rather. The word onesh here in the Torah is used for this particular penalty, the nema lahalan. And later on in Dvarim, when he talks about a man who defames a young woman and claims that she was not a betulah, whereas in fact she was and he spoke Lashon Hara, he has to pay her money. It's a financial penalty. And there it says, v'anshu oto, it uses the same word, onesh. So you see, says the Mechilta, that onesh means financial penalty. Just as it means that there, so it means that here, malahalan mamon, afkan mamon. So from here alone, it doesn't sound as though losing a fetus or causing the loss of a fetus is going to be some kind of a capital or homicide crime. Now, where is murder prohibited in the Torah? Number 5, makeh ish vameit. If you hit an ish and the ish dies, mot yumat. Mot yumat means the perpetrator must be put to death. Now, what does an ish mean? A man. What if you hit a woman and a woman dies? No. Is that still a crime?
It's a crime, but it's not the same.
No, it is the same. Number 6, Mechilta, it says the same, it says number 6. Makish, Eile Ela Ish, Eile Ela Shehiket Ish. From this pasuk alone, see, the word Ish is not clear in Hebrew, just like it's not clear in English. The word man, is man with a little M as in a male, or is it man with a big M as in human being? Okay? We have the same word, just like the Torah has the same word for ish. Ish could be human. So the Gemara wants to clarify, do I mean man as in male, or do I mean any person? I only know from this, maybe I might be mistaken, think it's just a male. Hikaita isha, what if you hit a woman and she died? Or it's a katan. Or if you hit a child who is not yet an ish is only above bar mitzvah. Minayin, how do we know? We'll see whether an ish is above bar mitzvah. Talmud Loma brings another posuk. Ve'ish ki yakeh kol nefesh adam mot yumat. Oh, elsewhere in Vayikra it says kol nefesh adam. If you hit or if you attack, kol nefesh adam, any human being, mot yumat. Lahavi, this clearly includes, says the Mechilta, eshehikata isha ve'etakota. So there is no question, and we'll see in a minute, if a person were to hit any human being, a child, a man, a woman, and that person died, that is murder. Shmoeniaf ben shmona b'mashma. What about a ben shmona? Now, ben shmona is a code word. It doesn't mean a child which is 8 years or 8 months old. Ben shmona means an embryo, a premature child which is born in the 8th month. Born in the 8th month, okay? Where the expectation was, certainly in the time of Chazal, there is no way that child will live. It's basically dead in the water. Nothing, you will not be able to live at all. What if someone were to attack that, and it's born? It's not an embryo, it's a born child. Talmud Loma Maka Ish. The Torah says no, it has to be an Ish. Magid She'ein Chayev, it's only Chayev. We'll see what chayiv means. Achi yarog ben kayama. You're only liable to the death penalty for murder if you were to murder someone who is a ben kayama, which is a viable child. And a premature child is not a viable child, and therefore if someone were to kill a premature child, they would not be liable to the death penalty. They're not chayav. Now, very important point. Chayav means chayav mita, liable to the death penalty. Even if you say patur, they're exempt from the death penalty, that doesn't mean that it's allowed, and that doesn't mean that it's not murder. That's a very important point. There is such a thing in halakha as murder, which is for technical reasons exempt from the death penalty. For example, if a person were to kill a treifer, what's a treifer? We usually use the word treifer to refer to animals, cows and sheep. But actually a person can be a treifer. Yeah, what does a treifer mean? A person could be a treifer, meaning that they have a disease which is very likely to kill them in the short term, and therefore they're effectively somebody who hasn't got long to live. If a person were to kill a treifer, says the Gemara, it's definitely murder. It's definitely murder, but you're not tied to the death penalty, because they can't kill the murderer for that, because you never know 100% whether you were the one that killed the person, or whether the illness killed the person. You can never be 100% sure, and therefore it's still murder, but it's just not technically liable. So maybe here too, if you killed this non-viable early premature child, You're not liable to the death penalty, that's clear, but who says that that's not still murder? Once the baby is viable though, number 7, tinok ben yom echad, a newborn, healthy, viable child, even one day old, hahorgo, if you kill that child, chayah. That's chayah. Chayav means it's murder and it's capital punishment. So there's no idea of a child not being a human being once it's born. There is a discussion, of course, in modern day society of what they call post-birth abortion, postpartum abortion, which is just a nice way of trying to euphemistically say killing babies for whatever reason that they have certain genetic problems or physical defects, etc. Now that is not legal in certainly in the Western world, as far as I'm aware, anywhere in the Western world, but there is a lot of discussion in the ethics community to try and suggested that should be. Some famous people, I'm sure you've heard of Peter Singer. Peter Singer is the professor of bioethics in Princeton, and he was very involved in animal rights in the 70s and 80s, and he very clearly, you can Google him and look up his opinions on this, he very clearly feels that infants up to the age of a month are effectively not really sentient in any way, and therefore it should ethically be permitted to kill them for certain reasons, not for no reason, but for certain reasons. Now, there's nothing to talk about, even to suggest, in the halachic system on this. Once a baby is born, we'll see what born means, then they're a human being fully. Yes?
Nowadays, an 8-month-old baby is perfectly fine.
Correct. And therefore, when Chazal talk about 8-month-old babies, and they say things like, you can't break Shabbat to save an 8-month, i.e. premature baby, that does not apply today. Because an 8-month gestated baby today is fully viable, in many cases, even a 7-month. Although it's interesting, Chazal were more relaxed about a 7-month than an 8-month. Which, without getting into why that could be now. But even now, a 6-month gestated baby is viable, which is interesting because the halachic cut-off date for abortion in many jurisdictions is way later than what is considered to be a viable baby today in terms of premature. But so yes, 100%, if you were to ask a diet, I don't know what the... Well, we don't have capital punishment today, so it's not relevant. But if we did have capital punishment, the question is, if somebody killed a, God forbid, a premature baby that was viable, I'm sure that would be seen as the same as a... But I'm not sure, because I'm not, and that's not for me to decide right today. Now, the point here is that it seems that there is a slight difference between a premature baby, or even an embryo or a fetus, than a fully born child in terms of capital punishment. What is the status when it comes to non-Jews? And this is when it gets interesting. Because in number 8, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, Ben Noach, a non-Jew, Neherag, is subject to the death penalty. Now, the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach, one of them is murder, right? Non-Jews are not allowed to murder under the halachic system. Mishum Rabbi Yishmael Amru, Rabbi Yishmael said that this death penalty applies to Af al ha'ubarim, even on an embryo. Now that's interesting, because we just went through saying that a Jew, whether it's murder or not, we'll see soon, but a Jew is not liable to the death penalty for killing an embryo. A non-Jew apparently is. My time murder, Rabbi Yishmael. What is the reason for Rabbi Yishmael? Because we just said an embryo is not an ish. It's not a person. It's not a viable person. So why would you be liable the death penalty for murdering an embryo if you're non-Jewish? Because it says there's a pasuk in Noach. Where is the prohibition of murder first mentioned in the Torah for non-Jews universally? Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam damo yishafech. Now, where do you put the comma there? Now, the way it's the cancellation marks, the way the ta'amim go, it's very clear, like I read it. Shofech dam ha'adam, comma, anyone who spills the blood of a person, comma, ba'adam damo yishafech, then they are liable to be killed by a human court. Okay, if you're a murderer, there's a capital punishment. However, Chazal said, Eidah ha'adam shehu ba'adam, they put the comma in a different place, and they say, Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam, comma, if you spill the blood of a person inside a person, damo yishafech, then that's a capital punishment. Who is a person inside a person? That is an embryo. A fetus. And therefore the law for non-Jews apparently is stricter than the law for Jews. Maybe, we'll see. Which is clearly that the Rambam passage is number 9, Ben Noach, a non-Jewish person, Sheharag, nefesh, that kills any person, afilu ubar, even a fetus, b'mei imo, which is still in utero, neherag alav, is liable to the capital punishment. So this, on this point, everybody agrees that if a non-Jew were to perform an abortion, that would be murder and a capital crime in halacha. The question is, what's with a Jew? Yes. No, because the Chazal are giving a drash. And when Chazal give a drash, they're not subject to the classic rules of the traditional trop and grammar, etc., and context. And they drash works with, it's like 3D glasses. You know, when you go to a 3D movie, you put on your 3D glasses and everything looks different. When you put on your drash glasses and you read the psukim, then drash works in a different way. I'm not getting into drash now. That's a broader conversation. Everybody agrees that the pshat of the posik is like the notes go, but clearly, halachically, which is based on drash, halachically a non-Jew may not abort a baby. Now, to save the life of the mother, that's a good question. We'll get to that, but not right now. What is it with Jews? What's the situation with Jews? And here, and we'll see this is very important, and I'll tell you why in a minute, Tosfos has come up with a comment in a few places around Shas, which we'll see in number 10. Can it be, Tosfos asks, that something is not allowed, something is prohibited for a non-Jew, but yes allowed for a Jew? Is there any situation in which the halakha for Jews is more lenient than for non-Jews? Or are we always stricter? Do we always have to have more restrictions? They can eat this, we can eat less. So what about here? And Tosfos has come up with this principle and said, number 10, le kamidi, there is absolutely nothing at all, there cannot be anything, de Yisrael shari, which for a Jew is permitted, but for a non-Jew is prohibited. It can't be. If you see that it's not allowed for a non-Jew, it must be the same for a Jew. Even though a non-Jew is liable for the death penalty, al ha'ubarim, for a killing of a fetus, as we've just seen, he says, v'Yisrael ein neherag, and a non-Jew, sorry, a Jew is technically not liable to the death penalty. Nahi de patora. I agree that there's a technicality. As I said before, it's like someone who killed a traitor. It's like someone who killed a person who was going to die anyway, and you get off the death penalty on a technicality. Mikol makom lo shari. But it is certainly asur. It is certainly not allowed. It cannot possibly be that for a Jew, he says, abortion is allowed. It can't be. Because for a non-Jew it's prohibited, and Jews are non-Jews plus more prohibitions, not less prohibitions. And therefore Tosfos learns it has to be that there is a prohibition on abortion. Now he doesn't specify what it is. Is it murder? Is it something else? But he said it absolutely has to be a prohibition. Okay? Because there is nothing on which a non-Jew... Now you're all thinking, is there anything that a non-Jew can't do that a Jew can do? Yeah, I'm trying to think if we can prove Tosfos wrong. I don't know, did anyone come up with anything yet?
No, but this is respective of the age of the fetus.
Ah, so we'll get to that as well. We'll get to that as well. Because how are we going to define like a one day is the same? We'll see that next week more. What's that? Loans? No, that's worse, the opposite. Because we're not allowed to lend to Jews and we are allowed to lend to non-Jews. Oh yeah, but from our perspective they're allowed. The Catholics have their own thing that they decided, that they selective in which mitzvahs they apply. From our perspective, Jews are allowed to lend on interest. Non-Jews are allowed to lend on interest halachically. It's not the police, don't worry, it's not a raid, it's fine. Let's go on a little bit. There is another posik which is suggested as well, and then we'll get into the to why this blew up into a major issue. There is another posik in number 11. Make behema yishal mena. If you hit an animal, if you kill an animal, then you have to pay. Make adam, but if you hit an adam, you must. Then you have to die. Okay, who is that talking about? Look at the Meshech Chokhmah number 12. Now, here is an interesting Parshanut point. What is the difference between Yumat and Mot Yumat? Sometimes the Torah says Mot Yumat, and sometimes the Torah says Yumat. Is there a difference? Says the Meshech Chokhmah. Yes, absolutely. Number 12. So Shabbat Shabbaton La Hashem Kol Ha'aseh B'Malacha Yumat. This is talking about a separate issue, which I'm not getting into right now. It says, Hinei B'Chol Makom Diksiv mita, whenever it says in the Torah there's a death penalty by court, Diksiv motyumat, it always says double losh, no motyumat. Levad makomot, you'll see him in a klal apart from a few exceptional issues. Katuv, for example, it says hashor yisakel, this is talking about an animal which kills. If you have a dangerous animal which kills a person, so he says hashor yisakel, that the animal has to be stoned. Vagamba alav yumat, and the owner of the animal also dies. But that is not a death penalty in a court. That is a miti bidei shamayim, meaning unless the owner does some kind of tshuva and gives some kind of compensation, then they are liable to death min hashamayim. Kedarish b'mechilsa. B'chein hu kasa b'parshat emor u'make behemi shamayim u'make adam yumat. And we see this pasuk that we're dealing with here when it says if you hit a person yumat yitachein demake adam kai ala ubrim. It could be, he says, this applies to fetuses, like we saw before. Shekein kasuv shofech dam hadam be'adam haynu ubar ba'adam damo yishafech. When it comes to non-Jews, for sure killing a fetus is a capital crime. Shebenoach ne'erag aleihem, a non-Jew is killed capitally for that. V'Yisrael nimsa mitato lidinei shamayim. So the Meshech Chochma seems to come out and say, since it says yumat here, we see that it is murder on some level to kill a fetus, even for a Jew. But there's no capital crime, like we were saying before. Just because Tosfot said patur, like Tosfot said patur, it doesn't mean mutar, and it could still be murder. When did this come out as a big issue? So let me give you a little bit of historical context. In 1976, there was a case that came out in Shaarei Tzedek Hospital. Interesting, 1976 was just a few years after Roe versus Wade. But that's not, I think, don't think relevant here. Living across the road from Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in the 1970s was a rav called Rav Waldenberg. It's Eliezer Waldenberg. Now, Rav Waldenberg wasn't the rav of Shaarei Tzedek. He was a rav that lived across the road from Shaarei Tzedek, but he davened in the minyan in the hospital, and he used to give shiurim for the doctors in the hospital because they liked his shiurim. So the junior doctors, there was medical ethics had not been advanced in Jewish medical ethics to the same degree then. Rav Jacobowitz was beginning to write about it in the 60s and the 70s, etc. And the doctors are often sent shilas. Rav Avram Steinberg, who of course now is exceptionally famous as one of the leading medical ethicists in the Jewish world, he was a junior doctor there in Shaarei Tzedek as well, and they used to send shilas to Rav Waldenberg because they got to know him, they liked to shear him, and he was a major poisek at the time. So one of the shilas they sent him was the following. They had a woman who was in her 6 months pregnancy, and they discovered that the baby had Tay-Sachs, which, as everyone knows, is a very tragic disease, Tay-Sachs. The baby would have very limited life expectancy. There was no cure, there still is no cure, etc. And the question was, can they abort the baby? And they sent a tshuva, a shayla rather, to Rav Waldenberg. And he came back next week with a 15-page tshuva. And we'll see his tshuva in more detail next week. He said, yes, it is absolutely permitted to abort the baby. And we'll see why he said that next week. Rav Steinberg was a junior doctor, and he was just launching a new publication, a new journal called Asya, which became a very famous, and still is a very famous, medical halachic journal. So he felt this would be a very good idea to launch his journal with such a landmark tshuva by the Tzitz Eliezer. And he asked the Tzitz Eliezer, does he mind if he publishes his tshuva? And he said, no, it's fine, publish the tshuva. So they published the tshuva, and it became a very well-known psef. The response from Rav Moshe Feinstein was swift and furious. And Rav Moshe Feinstein came back with the sources we've just seen and more and said, how can you say this? Killing a fetus, terminating a fetus, let's not use the word killing because we're trying to define it, terminating a fetus is murder. And we see this because he said, you can see a non-Jew is liable to capital punishment for killing a fetus. Tosfos says clearly there is nothing that applies to a non-Jew that doesn't also apply to a Jew. And even though a Jew may be technically off the hook in terms of capital crime, capital punishment, it's still murder. And we saw with the Meshech Chochma, there may be a punishment from Shamayim rather than from a court, but it's murder. And you cannot murder a fetus in order to avoid a birth of a fetus with Tay-Sachs. And he was extremely very upset about the psak of the Tzitz Eliezer. The Tzitz Eliezer was a bit put out that the letter came back so vociferously and wanted to find an opportunity to reply. I heard a shift from Rav Steinberg. Rav Steinberg, a few months later, brought out his first personal, his book, his first sefer on medical issues, and he asked Tzitz Eliezer for a haskama. And the Tzitz Eliezer said to him, "Oh, this will be a perfect opportunity for me to write back against Rav Moshe Feinstein." And Rav Steinberg says, "You really have to do that in my book. Like, this is my first book and I'm a junior doctor. Can you find maybe another situation to do that?" And he said, "All right then, I won't do it in your haskama because I don't want to cause you trouble." But the Tzitz Eliezer did write back. And this became a very big debate. But Rav Moshe Feinstein was absolutely confident that it was murder to terminate the embryo, the fetus. And he would not allow it. And the Tzitz Eliezer clearly felt it was not. We'll see why in a minute. Yes?
Why wasn't it considered a traitor?
And even if the baby was considered a traitor, you can't murder a traitor. Everyone agrees it's murder to kill a traitor. You can't go around finding people who are, God forbid, terminally ill and saying, "Well, you know, we may as well kill people." Absolutely, it's murder to even a gossess. A gossess, someone who is imminently about to die, you can't even touch a gossess because in case you might precipitate the death. So even if it was a traitor, in that sense, although a traitor, maybe someone's going to die in a year and Tay Sachs has a longer life, but still it would not be, that would not help. Fine, let's go on a little bit. There is a problem here. We have a problem. Okay? Rav Moshe Feinstein has a problem, yes.
Did they inquire the mother what she wanted?
Yes, of course. I don't know all the details of the case, but they certainly don't do things without the consultation with the mother. They would never, I don't think, abort the fetus against the wishes of the mother as long as she was mentally competent. But and I don't know the details of this case, but I'm sure that's the case. We have a problem, though, halachically. And the problem arises in number 15, which is the following. What if the fetus is endangering the life of the mother? So everybody knows the answer, and it comes from number 15. Ha'isha shehi maksha lelet. A woman who is having trouble giving birth. Now, giving birth is always trouble of one kind or another, but here it means that there is a real medical emergency going on, and we know that if this woman continues with the birthing process, she will die. Mechatchin et ablad b'meyeha. Yes. No, I understand. But the life-threatening has to be judged given the medicine of the day. What was life-threatening then was life-threatening then. What was then life-threatening now would not be life-threatening, and there will be different things which are life-threatening. The question is not then and now. The question is it or is it not life-threatening? If she is in a life-threatening situation, what do we do? Mechatchin et ablad. We are obligated to abort the fetus. We cut up the fetus, the meyaha inside her, umotzim oto ibarim ibarim, and we perform an abortion and we take it out. Because her life takes priority over the life of the fetus. Yatsa rubo, once the majority of the fetus has emerged, and we're here we're talking about a breech birth. It comes out feet first, once the majority of the body has emerged. If it's a normal birth, which is head first, then it's once the majority of the head has emerged. Ein nogimbo. We can't touch the baby now, we can't do anything to it. She'ein dochi nefesh mipnei nefesh. Because we can never take a life to save a life. We don't kill one person to save another person. Okay? Once the baby is born, sufficiently halachically, which means it's more than halfway out, either the head or the body, depending on which way it's presenting, we can't touch the baby, we just have to try our best. But before the baby is born, we are obligated to kill the baby to save the mother. Now, why is this a problem for Rav Moshe Feinstein, who says that it's murder to kill a fetus? Because if it's murder to kill a fetus, then how can we murder one person to save another person? You can't do that. You cannot murder one person to save another person, ever. And if a fetus really is a full person and it's full-blown murder to kill it, why on earth is it allowed to set aside the fetus for the life of the mother? Who says that the life of the fetus is less than the life of the mother?
Maybe the thing is someone is threatening someone else.
Oh, we'll get to it. Oh, good. That's next week's share. You're ahead of the game. And we'll see that the Gemara discusses that and actually dismisses that a little bit. We'll see that he says that the baby is not really a rodef because it's a natural process. It's a natural process. Meaning, we saw last week that such a thing as a rodef, which is even if an innocent person is threatening another person, we take out the threat to save the person. But here the Gemara says the baby is even less than an innocent person. This is called natural like birth. And therefore, maybe we come. But we'll get back to that because the Rambam brings it back in. That's not for now. So, yes.
There is a discussion of Rachel, Imenu, and Benjamin.
In what context?
That he threatened her life and she...
I presume there's nothing they could do there. The, you know, the baby was born and she died afterwards. It's an interesting question because I don't know. It doesn't give details about Rachel Imenu why she died afterwards. But many maternal mortalities for the baby was after the baby was born because they weren't able to stop the bleeding, they weren't able to stop infection, etc., etc. And then there's nothing we can do because the baby's already born.
Yeah.
Now, Rashi explains why this is that we can kill, that we must kill the baby to save the mother. Number 16. Because as long as the baby has not come out into the world, avir ha'olam, lav nefeshu, says Rashi. Lav nefeshu. It's not really a nefesh. And you're allowed to kill it to save the mother. But once its head comes out, you can't touch it or to kill it. Yalud rather, it's now born. Interesting. Says Rashi, in the womb, the fetus is not a nefesh. That's why you can kill it. It's not a nefesh. So what is it? A pre-nefesh? A proto-nefesh? And if it's not a nefesh, why does Rav Moshe Feinstein think it's murder to kill it? So one answer might be the following. Why is it that you cannot indeed kill one person to save another person? What's the problem? Who's more important? Look at number 17. Rotzeh gufi min alam. How do we know that you're not allowed to kill to save life? Sorry, it's logical, says number 17. Tahahu da'asa lakami da'rabba. As someone came up to Rabba, Amalei, and he said to him, Amalei marad duri katle laploni ve'ilo katle lach. If someone says to him, to you, kill this man or I'll kill you, Amalei, you have to say, b'kadlech v'lotik atol, you have to be killed rather than killed. You, why? Why is this the case? So he answered him, "My chazi de dama di dech sumak tvei." And this is the logical: who knows whose blood is redder? As it me, i.e., whose life is worth more? Dilma dama dahu gavra sumak tvei. How do you know your life is more valuable than the life of another person? Someone, God forbid, sticks a gun to a person's head and says, "If you don't kill them, I'll kill you." So you can save your life. Why is your life more valuable than their life? We don't turn around and say the life of one person can be assessed. Life is infinite. The life of a 95-year-old person who is sick is no less of a life than the life of a 5-year-old child who is healthy, who has his whole life in front of them. We see this all the time. Now, that's true of people who are alive. But can we say the same thing of an embryo? Or is intuitively the life of an embryo is not the same as the life of a born person? So you could, and that's what the Minchas Chinuch suggests. So you can still say that it's murder to kill an embryo, but in the case of the embryo and the mother, you can, or the fetus, I should stop saying embryo, because embryo is really only up to about 8 weeks, 9 weeks, but the fetus, to kill the fetus to save the mother does make sense, even if it would normally be murder, because in that case you can say that the life of this one is less than the life of that one, because intuitively we understand that where there's a choice between the fetus and the mother has to take priority. So that doesn't necessarily say that that the life of the, that it's not murder to kill the fetus, because we could understand it in that way. Let's go on to another different approach. Yes.
The fetus is just supposed to get to the mother.
Yes.
But I think in today's world, there are twins, for example. And
good.
Would he still want to eat
it? That's a fascinating question, which we'll deal with. Which is, fetus versus mother, it makes sense. I understand the fetus is less, quote unquote, than the mother, intuitively. But what about one fetus versus another fetus? What if I need to kill this fetus to save this one in multiple pregnancies? What if I grow a fetus to produce stem cells to save someone else who is not the mother, another, a sibling or something like that? We'll discuss that, please God, not today, but in due course. Let's do some other things. We've got a bit of time left and we've got a lot to do. Okay, so maybe it's murder, maybe it's not murder. We'll see. Rav Moshe said it's definitely murder and we answered some of the questions on him, but other people say differently, and we have another Gemara which causes a problem for the murder thesis. Let's have a look at number 18. This is talking about a rather unusual situation where a woman has been assessed as guilty of a capital crime. And we're taking her out to kill her. Okay, she's whatever it is. She was a murderer, murderess, and we have to give her capital punishment. But we discover she's pregnant. What should we do? Says the Mishnah, Ha'ish she'yatza le'hareg, a woman who is taken out to be killed in a capital case. Ein mamtinin la'ashit heled, we don't wait until she gives birth. Unfortunately, she's pregnant. She dies, the fetus dies with her. But if the woman is already in the process of giving birth, she's on the birthing stool, birth has already begun, we'll have to define what that is. Then we wait until she has the baby. She has the baby, and then we'll take her out for capital punishment because she can't escape that. So the Gemara wants to know why, and says, Pshita, I don't need to know this. I don't need you to tell me that if the woman is pregnant, then we still carry out the death penalty, and unfortunately the fetus gets killed. That's obvious, says the Gemara. Gufahi, gufahi. The fetus is just part of her body. She has fingers. She has liver. She has kidneys. She has a fetus. It's part of her body. Of course, her finger is not, it's not murder to chop off a finger. It's not murder to take out a kidney. I mean, you need to have a good reason to do it. So too, it's not murder to kill a fetus. It's part of her body. So the Gemara says, no, it's there. I need to just reinforce it and tell you. Because you might have thought, since it says, Ka'asha yashid alav balaisha, because why do we need to tell you that we still kill the woman? Because mamona debalhu, because the father has a monetary interest in the fetus. There's a monetary value to the fetus. The lawyer said to me, how do we know we're allowed to take the husband's money away by killing the fetus? Amazing. Kamash malan, we see this. But yashva ala mashbe, but once she's giving birth, my time, why is that now prohibited to kill her? Kevan da akar, since the baby now has moved, I think what we'd say it's now presented. The baby is now presented for birth. Gufa achrinahu. Now the baby's a different body. It's not her body anymore. The baby has moved. Now this is very interesting, because the Gemara, the Mishnah, and the Gemara here seems to say very clearly that a fetus is just a part of the mother's body until it starts to present for birth, and therefore we're not worried about the fetus. In fact, the words of the Ram in number 19 on this Gemara, he says, "Lavlad, as far as the fetus is concerned, kevan shelo yata la'avir aloam, since it doesn't come out, hasn't come out yet, loy chashinan. We don't even take any notice of it. We're not interested. We're not worried about it." How far is that your loy chashinan? We're not worried, and therefore it's a zero, or we're not worried in other ways. So the Radvaz has a fascinating tshuva. And the Radvaz has the following, it's a very tragic, difficult situation. He talks about the situation of a woman who has nebach died in childbirth. She's died already. And there's nothing we can do to save the fetus. There's nothing we can do. They didn't have the technology to do that. He says, and one of the practices the midwives had was that they would kill the fetus inside the nebach dead mother, because there's nothing you can do. They may as well bring it to an early end and put the whole story to rest. Is that right or is that wrong? They asked the shayla to the Radvaz. Is it okay for the midwives to kill the fetus inside the dead mother because there's nothing that can be done to save it? We'll see next week, if you can save the fetus, you have to break Shabbos even to save the fetus. We'll see why that is. Can they do what their practice was to do? Look at his tshuva number 20. It's the third line. Vadai roi le'go'or ben hashim ha'osat kacha. You should stop the women doing that. That's not the right thing to do, he says, for the midwives. Mishum demechzi, because it looks like ke'ein ritzicha. It looks like a type of murder. Now, the word mechzi is a very interesting word. Mechzi is usually a rabbinic prohibition. It looks like, because I mechzi, different, completely different. Mechzi kemavashel on Shabbos. There are rabbinic levels of cooking on Shabbos which are prohibited only on a rabbinic level, because they resemble cooking. People would call that cooking. Also completely different to this case. So mechzi normally indicates a rabbinic prohibition. He says that this is not murder, but it looks like murder. Aval ein v'davar zeh lo mishum ritzicha. It's for sure not murder. If it was murder, we certainly couldn't do murder. It's certainly not murder because it's not come out into the world. And the fact that we break Shabbos to save the fetus, again, next week we'll see why that is. That's not a concern, and therefore the Radbaz says it's definitely not murder. It's definitely not murder, no question about it. It's some kind of prohibition, maybe even a rabbinic prohibition to carry out an abortion. And we'll see that this, to a large degree, and this is not alone, there were other tumors of this nature, and Rav Valdenberg, when he said that the doctors were allowed to carry out the abortion of the 6-month gestated Tay Sachs baby, then he was coming much more from this position, which is that it's definitely not murder. Maybe it's some kind of rabbinic prohibition, and if it's a rabbinic prohibition, for sure you will be allowed to do that where there is a serious issue for the health of the mother or the mental health of the mother or other reasons or deformities. We'll see that next week as well. And therefore, we see that there's a very different approach here, which Rav Moshe completely pushes aside with two hands. This approach would say that abortion is a much lower level prohibition, maybe even on a rabbinic level prohibition. What about that Tosfos that Rav Moshe said? Surely there's nothing that a Jew is allowed to do, or that's on a lesser level than a non-Jew is not allowed to do. Well, it's not so straightforward, because I'm sure your brains have been trying to think of things that non-Jews can't do that Jews can do. And in fact, it could be that whole principle is not actually agreed upon by other people. For example, the Rambam. Paskin's a very interesting case. What if, and this case may be familiar to some people, what if a cow was shechted, but it's still twitching? If you were to cut a limb off that cow, is it Eva Minachai or not Eva Minachai? Is the cow alive or is the cow not alive? And the Rambam rules there that for non-Jews, the cow is alive, because it's only dead when it's dead. And if it's moving, then it's not dead. And therefore, if a non-Jew were to cut a limb off, that's Eva Minachai. But for a Jew, it's shechted. Shechted means shechted. And that's it. You can eat the meat once it's shechted. I mean, you have to kashrut it, obviously. But he says, and therefore you see that rather obscure case is indeed a case where something is permitted for a Jew, but prohibited for a non-Jew, so maybe it's not so straightforward. Just let me finish off with two other suggestions, and we'll pick these up next week. The Chavos Ya'ir comes along in the 17th century and says that abortion is definitely prohibited, but he gives a different reason. He doesn't say it's murder, thank you so much. He doesn't say it's murder, and he doesn't say it's a rabbinic prohibition. He says it's a Torah prohibition, which is what? A Torah prohibition of taking away potential life. And he brings a proof from the issue of wasting male seed. We are not allowed to do that. Because that is a life in potential, there is a prohibition to do that. If you look for a second in number 22, Asur lahotzi shichvat zera levatola, a person is not allowed to waste semen for no reason. She'isu gadol, who it is a serious prohibition, ke'ilu harag hanefesh. It's as if you're killing. You're not really killing, it's not actually murder, but it's very severely prohibited. Said the Chavos Ya'ir, if already it is prohibited to waste even an unfertilized egg, semen, as it were, all the more so a fertilized embryo or fetus, which is even more potential life, and therefore he said we cannot carry out abortion because it is terminating a potential life. Now, this raises two fascinating questions, which is you're not allowed to waste potential life for no reason. But what about for a reason, and what is the reason, and what if it's a good reason, like a deformed baby, etc.? How does that work? And secondly, it raises an issue which I've given you sources for on page 5, which I'm not getting into now, which is how does this involve women? Meaning, shichvat zera levatala is really an issue that applies to men. Does it apply to women? And we talked about this when we talked about birth control about a year ago, and we saw that there were a number of authorities that said that this whole isur does not apply in the same way to women, because women are not obligated in the same way in pru revu, and women are not therefore perhaps obligated in the same way of destroying what could be a potential life. Now, why is that important? Because, says the Tzitz Eliezer, it could be that according to the Chavos Ya'ir, if I need to carry out an abortion, then A, I should choose a Jewish doctor rather than a non-Jewish doctor, because for a non-Jewish doctor it would be a capital crime, but for a Jewish doctor it's less than that, what we're trying to deal with. And it may even be much better still to choose a woman doctor than a male doctor, because a woman doctor would raise this whole question, as if indeed, like the Chavos Ya'ir, the issue is destroying potential life, there may be a different dynamic halachically for the woman in that, because she's not in the same mitzvah. So another good reason to encourage your daughters to become female doctors, because female doctors clearly are, you know, God forbid we should have to perform such operations, but nevertheless there is a real halachic need for them. I think we'll leave it there. There is a lot more to say, and we will be saying it, because all we've done this week is lay the foundations. And I summarized at the bottom the situation so far. You can read this for yourself. Let me leave you just with an interesting conundrum. A Shiloh was asked in World War I. A halachic question was brought in the case of a German officer who had Nebuch raped a Jewish girl who became pregnant. He took her to the doctor, to a Jewish doctor, and demanded that the doctor abort the baby. The doctor refused to perform an abortion, and the German officer threatened to kill the doctor unless he performed the abortion. Does the doctor have to die rather than perform the abortion or not? That was the Shiloh that was asked, and I'll leave you to think about that between now and next week, when we will go on with this issue. Have a great week.